I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the inimitable radio personalities in this country joins me now. The host of CBC Radio's Quirks and Quarks, Bob MacDonald, has a new book out, Canadian Spacewalkers, Hadfield, McLean, and Williams. Remember the ultimate high adventure. The book explores the experiences had by Mr. Hadfield, Steve McLean, and Dave Williams. I'll get Mr. MacDonald to tell us about this book and some of the training he's done himself, that which astronauts do to prepare for going into space. But Bob MacDonald has been presenting the popular long-running Quirks and Quarks since 1992. The show's been on for 39 years now and airs Saturdays at noon across the country and on Sirius. He has written numerous books, which have won many prizes. He's the recipient of a number of honorary degrees from universities across the country. And in 2011 was invested as an officer of the Order of Canada. Visit cbc.ca/quirks for more information. The book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Bob MacDonald. Mr. MacDonald, good morning.
Hi, Joseph.
How are you?
I'm really well here in rainy Vancouver.
yeah, unfortunately. But you've been across the country promoting this book, have you?
I have. I launched it in Toronto. I did a couple of events there and then just outside Toronto. I was here in Vancouver last week for the LitFest, doing a presentation there. And then I was in Edmonton just a couple of days ago for their LitFest. And I'm here tonight to do a presentation at the planetarium. Then I'm going to continue on to do more in Victoria, where I live. And finally, towards the end of November, I'm doing a presentation in Ottawa at the Aviation and Space Museum there.
And from what I've heard, these presentations that you do, these talks that you do, I mean, they're well attended. I mean, you must have fans of the show attend, is that right?
Yes. I'm very fortunate to have a very dedicated Quirks and Quarks audience. And so they come, but there are also a lot of young people that come as well, which I'm delighted about. And during my presentations, I illustrate them. So I show images from the book of that were taken in space by these astronauts or of the astronauts themselves out there. Mm-hmm. And also I show a fun video of myself on a zero-G flight, which the astronauts affectionately call a vomit comet, experiencing weightlessness. And you can see how chaotic and crazy and giddy that whole thing is as well. So it's a lot of fun.
And so you did that to sort of train for the same training that astronauts do before they go into space. Is that right?
Well, you see, the advantage of being a journalist is that if you see something that you really want to do, you see some fun piece of equipment, then you go to the people that operate it, you say, hey, I'd like to do a story on that. I'd like to put that on television, or I'd like to write a radio program about it or something. And they usually say, okay, as long as you're fit. So I've had the privilege of doing that a number of times over my career. The zero-G flight was one of the highlights, but I've also been spun up in centrifuges and had my weight increased two or three times. I've been in machines that are designed to take away your sense of up and down so that you don't know where up is, and that's a big problem in space as well. And a few other things that gave me just a little taste of what these people who go into space experience. And the thing about space walkers is that there are very few of them. There's only about 100 people worldwide that have done it, and only 3 Canadians who have done it. So you can be an astronaut. I mean, all spacewalkers are astronauts, but not all astronauts are spacewalkers. So the 3 Canadians that have done this take flying in space to the next level. It takes a whole other level of training. It takes extra years of training to learn how to do that. And it's a very profound experience to open the door, step out into empty space with nothing below you for 400 kilometers as you're passing over the Earth. It takes 14 minutes to cross Canada. Or you look out into the black and you think about how big the universe is and you're just out there suspended, hanging on with one hand on the outside of a structure. And so it's pretty amazing.
So you went on this zero-G flight?
Yep.
The vomit comet, I think you called it?
Right.
Did you throw up?
No, I didn't.
No.
And the reason you don't is because the airplane has no windows in it. You can't see what the airplane is doing, and that's good because you get sick when there's a conflict in your brain between what your eyes are seeing and what your other organs of balance. We have organs in our ears and in our neck and throughout our body that tell us where up and down are. And usually they agree with what our eyes are seeing. So if you tilt your head to the side, there are little fluids in your head that slosh around and say, yes, I'm tilting to the right. And your eyes see the world get a little bit crooked. So that's okay. But if you get signals from the organs in your ears and your eyes do not see the same thing, your brain gets confused and says, well, which one do I believe? And it turns out, just by coincidence, that if you take a poison, it, for some reason, affects your organs of balance. You get dizzy. So the body's response to a conflict between these sensory inputs to your brain is that you've been poisoned, and the best response to poison is to get rid of whatever's in your stomach. So that's why you have that tendency. But so what they do in the airplane is that you can't see what the airplane is doing. You're just in this tube, and they fly a very particular path called a parabola, which is the natural curve that a baseball falls when you throw it through the air, anything you throw in the air. And for 30 seconds, it's just like somebody turned gravity off, and your whole body comes up, and you just start floating around. And it's wonderful, and you can go in any direction. It's not like being in a car or a roller coaster when you go over a hump and you feel your stomach come up, because there you're strapped in, and it is your stomach that's coming up. But when it's your entire body, it's really easy, and it's great, and it's a lot of fun.
So all the sort of training that you did, the aspects of training that you did yourself, did you find it, I mean, obviously interesting, fun? Was there anything that bordered on the scary, perhaps, or the life-threatening?
I wouldn't say scary, but certainly I just got a little taste of it, and I only did it a couple of times. We did 15 of those parabolas on the zero-g airplane. When the astronauts go up, they do 50 or 60 of them, and they do it many, many times, over many, many days and weeks and years. And I've realized that it takes a lot of skill to do these things. I was bouncing around like a clown. Okay, well, that was all right. But to be able to maneuver yourself, I've learned why astronauts move in slow motion when you see them in space. You have to move in slow motion, because if you touch anything, you push against a wall or any surface nearby, you just start going in the opposite direction, and you cannot stop yourself until you hit the wall on the other side. And usually you're tumbling end over end, and so you got to do everything with your fingertips. You got to be really gentle and slow, point yourself in the direction you want to go, launch, and then fly like Peter Pan through the air, really slowly, and get there without hitting anything. And they have to develop these skills. And then to imagine taking that and having to do construction work, because that's what spacewalking was all about, is to build the space station. So they got to go outside in this big bulky suit, wearing the equivalent of hockey gloves and a fishbowl over their head. The suit itself doesn't like to bend because there's no air outside, but there's air inside, so it wants to balloon out. You got to fight the suit. And then you got to handle wrenches and screwdrivers and drills and all kinds of things in this bulky suit and while you're floating weightless. So it takes a lot of skill. It takes strength. It takes stamina. It takes concentration. And it's not as easy as they make it look.
And so these three guys have these qualities, obviously, because they're the only three that have gone into space and walked, Canadians, that is. What did you learn about who these guys were, who these guys are, in the course of writing this book?
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I did the book was I sat down with all three of them for really long chats, and I didn't do this through Quirks and Quarks. It was one-on-one, personal, sit down, have dinner, sit in a hotel room, whatever. And I recorded them, and the book is a transcript of that recording, so it's in their own words. And they're all very different. Everyone knows Chris Hadfield from his time on the International Space Station as the commander. And I've known Chris the most of all the Canadian astronauts. And I first followed him to Russia in 1995 when he was going up for the very first time in space. And he went up to the Russian space station Mir. And used the Canada arm to do some construction work there from the inside. And it was on his second flight in 2001 where he became Canada's first space walker. And he mounted Canada arm 2 on the outside of the space station. It was totally appropriate that a Canadian assemble the Canadian contribution to the space station, this giant big Canada arm 2. And Chris is, all he ever wanted to do since he was a kid was become an astronaut, and he did that. And he's the ultimate overachiever. He's a Top Gun test pilot. He's an astronaut. He's a spacewalker. He's a commander. He's a writer. He's a musician. He's the ultimate. Everything he does well. Steve McLean is a completely different kind of guy. Still very focused. He was a gymnast when he was in university, and he found that his gymnastics training actually helped him in space, because in gymnastics you're spinning around in all different directions and your sense of up and down gets confused and you have to know where you are. And he found that very helpful when he was in space. And he went out and he did some construction work on the big solar wings that stick out on either side of the space station covering an area larger than a football field, including the end zones. And then he came back and became the head of the Canadian Space Agency for 6 years. He's now working at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, working on quantum computers. So with Steve, he's tried very different things in his life, from being a gymnast to an astronaut to a spacewalker to an administrator and now a researcher. So that's sort of his interesting characteristic. Dave Williams is a medical doctor, and he went up into space the first time to study the effects of space flight on the brain and all of these crazy interactions I was talking about earlier. And then on his second flight, he went up and did a spacewalk, and he holds the record for the time outside for a Canadian. He did three spacewalks, and he was out for almost 18 hours. And then he went on, he's now the CEO of a hospital just north of Toronto. So all of them are very different. They're all very accomplished in what they do, and they came at it from different backgrounds. And I think that's what makes it all so interesting.
So what are the lessons there from these three guys that would be useful for us down here on Earth? I mean, they must have a perspective about Earth, life on Earth, having been away.
Absolutely, and everyone who flies in space does. Especially people who have flown more than once in space, because there tends to be a fairly large gap of many years between their flights. Uh-huh. And they can see differences between their first and second flight. They can see the growth of cities. They can see forests that have been cut down. They can see lakes that have dried up and turned into salt flats. They can see pollution. And all of them come away with a real sort of stewardship idea that this Earth is all they have. One of the things that surprised me when I was talking to all three of them is not only did they talk about the beauty of the Earth and the perspective of being outside, which Dave said the difference between being in the space station looking out the window and being out on a spacewalk is like driving down the road in a bus looking out the window and saying, oh, isn't the scenery nice, or being beside the bus in a convertible with the top down going through the same scenery. So they all appreciated the Earth. But what they also talked about was the blackness of space, that they could turn their back on the Earth. They could turn their back on the space station and just look out into the starry universe. Even during the day, the sky is black. And they all talked about how black it is, that it was the blackest black they've ever seen. It's much blacker than the dark skies we get here on the ground. And they thought about how far that goes, how deep it is. How many galaxies are out there, right up to the edge of the universe? We don't even know where the edge of the universe is. And they were just dangling there in this very deadly environment that could kill you in seconds. And then they turn back and look down on this beautiful oasis that we live on called planet Earth that's protecting us from that harsh environment. So, yeah, they come away with a profound sense of the beauty and the frailty and the preciousness of our beautiful planet.
So I'm sure when young people come and see you, or they because they're obviously interested in space and want to go there one day when they grow up, can Canadians today, can like a child today, can they grow up and become an astronaut like these three guys?
Well, we still have two Canadian astronauts who haven't flown yet, and I would say yes, but the message, and I do a whole chapter in the book on the message from all three of them, their message is face your dreams. Face your fantasies, whatever they are, whether it's to be an astronaut or whether it's to be whatever, doesn't matter what it is, but they have to be your dreams, not your parents, not your teachers, not your friends, your dreams, and keep yourself pointed in that direction, and every little opportunity that comes along that will take you a step closer to that, take it, and just keep going that way, and you will eventually get closer to it. And that's what all three of them did. And you may not get there as quickly as you want. The path that you take probably won't be the one you think it's going to be. You'll have diversions. You'll do other things. But don't give up on your dreams. And I think that's a pretty good message for all of us.
Yeah.
That no matter what it is, just keep at it. And these three people are living proof that that can really happen.
In the book, do you reflect on what's become the Hadfield phenomenon? I mean, the guy's become a superstar.
Yeah.
A figure just beyond anything imaginable that an astronaut could become, a real celebrity, beyond a celebrity.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the thing, when I talked to him about a year or so ago, he struck me as such a sanguine, tranquil guy at the same time.
Yep. He is. He's what you see is what you get. Chris is very genuine. He comes from, I've gotten to know his family, his parents, and they're all very genuine people, and they're all very determined to be the best at what they do. His dad was a captain for Air Canada for many years, and he was a world champion, or a Canadian champion aerobatic pilot. His brother is also now a captain at Air Canada and plays in a band, has his own band. He's got the other people in the family are pilots or military people. Like they've all said, okay, here's what we're going to do, and let's just be good at it. And that's a good ethic to have. They come from families that have supported them and said, hey, you can be the best, but you got to work really hard and don't give up.
And did he expect to get the attention that he got?
Chris feels that we put him up there. It was a Canadian taxpayer that put him in space. And he feels an obligation to bring that experience back to us. So he's doing it the best way he can. He did it the best way that he could while he was in space. And he's continuing to do that now with his public talks and his books. And he just feels that he owes us for the privilege of doing what he did, because so few people have done it. I think that's pretty noble.
Yeah, and I guess it speaks to the importance of going to space. I mean, at a time when expenditures and the public coffers are tight, I mean, there is an importance to go to space, isn't there?
Well, let me put that into perspective for Canada in terms of the public coffers and how much it costs. For the Canadian Space Agency budget, it costs each of us in Canada less than $10. $10 a year. That's what it costs us for their budget. And what do we get for that $10 a person? Well, we get incredible role models. I mean, Chris and Steve and Dave, the three spacewalkers, are only three of eight Canadians who've flown in space and two more who are waiting to fly. We get our highest demands for education. In order to be in that business, you've got to be well-educated and you've got to be the best at what you do. We get high technology. Canada produces satellites. We produce electronic instruments that go to space. Do you know that we have instruments on Mars right now?
Hmm.
The Curiosity rover that's running around on Mars has an instrument on it that was built in Guelph, Ontario. And that's what we do. We put out high-tech equipment. So that demands the highest standards of technology. And we're good at that, and we're known for that internationally. So for all of that, for $10, I think that's a pretty good deal. And we got Halloween coming up. We're going to spend way more than $10 on Halloween.
Yeah.
So just keep that in perspective. And do we need to do it? Sure. We need to find out about our universe. We need to find out about our place here. And we need to have people that get away from the Earth every once in a while and look down and say, hey, look at how beautiful it is. And look at how small it is. And look at what we're doing to it. Let's take care of it. Yeah, we need that. And we need the robots that go out to other worlds and find out that they're all different and that this Earth is very precious. We're finding thousands of planets around other stars, but we have yet to find another Earth. And that's a pretty big lesson. I'm sure there are other Earths out there, but they're going to be really, really far away and impossible for us to get to, at least at the moment. So this is it. Where we are, this is it. We live in the Garden of Eden, and the space program underlies that every day.
You know, I listen to you regularly. Because it's Saturdays at noon. I just, happen to be near a radio most weekends. And the thing that struck me about you over the years is that learning is obviously something that you do all the time, but it's still exciting to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like, I have a great job. I love what I do because every week it's different.
Uh-huh.
Every week, really smart people from all over the world show up and tell me their stories about what they have found. And it could be anything, from something out at the edge of the universe to the tiniest little quark. It could be back in time to creatures that roamed around here before we even existed. It could be projecting into the future. It could be anything. And it's all really fascinating, and it's all new. And when you think about the fact that we actually don't know what most of the universe is made of, there's this stuff out there called dark energy and dark matter. We haven't got a clue what it is, and it makes up 95% of the universe. So we only know 5% of what's out there. And we're working hard to figure that out. And it's an amazing process. Science is an incredible tool to help us figure that out. How the universe works, our place in it. And the fact that we even know that is astounding. And we're living during a time when we're figuring it all out. So, yeah, I find it incredible, and I feel very privileged to do what I do, to get to talk to these people. You know, whenever they hand out the Nobel Prizes, the winners are talking to me that week, and I pinch myself sometimes. How does this happen? You know, I'm talking to the person who just won the Nobel Prize. Wow. Mm. So it's a real privilege for me to do what I do.
And Quirks and Quarks seems to be doing better year after year.
Well, we're our ratings have never fallen. We're in our 40th year on the air, and the ratings for the show have never fallen. And we're a very small crew. There's only four of us that work on the show, and I'm only there part-time. I'm there Wednesday to Friday. We do each show each week. We don't plan much ahead. I can't even tell you what's on this Saturday's show. I don't know yet. I'll find out when I get in tomorrow. And it's great. We just let science stand on its own.
Yeah.
And let it speak for itself, and that seems to hold. And the interest in science seems to always be there, so I'm delighted about that.
Bob, it's been such a pleasure talking to you today. I can't wait to read this book. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Okay, I hope you enjoy it, Joseph. It's even got full-color pictures.
Really? Wow. There you go.
Okay. Bye-bye.
The book is called Canadian Spacewalkers Hadfield, McLean, and Williams, Remember the Ultimate High Adventure. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Quirks and Quarks airs Saturdays at noon on CBC Radio 1. Bob McDonald joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.